I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Dreams can be so mysterious. Why do we dream? What do they mean? Today we delve into books about dreams and dreaming. With us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Peter Abrahams. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so this was an interesting topic. Who knew there were so many books about dreams and dreaming?
Oh, it's just an immense field, and to organize all this, it, like dreams themselves, it just slips through your fingers.
Right. And every time you think you've got the, it's not unlike when we had to pick, when we were doing the 10 favorite books. It has a similar, like you create a list, and then you're like, no, I have to, well, what about that poem about dreams, or what about that short story, or, you know, did Sleeping Beauty dream? I mean, it becomes deeper and deeper as you go.
Well, it's impossible.
As you say, Peter, right. Like
yeah.
a dream.
It's just, this has been written about since Aristotle and even before, dreams and what they mean. And I mean, obviously, it's a huge thing in our lives, everybody's lives. I've always thought that maybe the whole reason for sleep is, you know, to dream. And in fact, in the research, there is some of that I think we might get to today.
Yeah. And who would have thought of the question, did Sleeping Beauty dream? I don't know that that ever would have crossed my mind.
Well, I don't know why, Mindy. It's such an obvious question.
We're going to get to that.
We will try to answer that question.
All right. So what's your first book, Jill?
Well, I had to start. In fact, when I decided, you know, we talked about this, we thought this would be a fun show. The first thing that I thought of was the opening line of Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, and which is well known, not just, of course, because it is the first line of the novel, but also because Hitchcock made an incredible film called Rebecca, based on this novel. And the first line, followed by a little bit more, is, "Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. It seemed to me I stood by the iron gate leading to the drive, and for a while I could not enter, for the way was barred to me. There was a padlock and a chain upon the gate. I called in my dream to the lodgekeeper and had no answer, and peering closer through the rusted spokes of the gate, I saw that the lodge was uninhabited. No smoke came from the chimney, and the little lattice windows gaped forlorn. Then, like all dreamers, I was possessed of a sudden, with supernatural powers, and passed like a spirit through the barrier before me. The drive wound away in front of me, twisting and turning as it had always done. But as I advanced, I was aware that a change had come upon it. It was narrow and unkept, not the drive that we had known." And it goes on. That whole first chapter is really about this dream. And dreams do keep coming back up during the course of the novel. And in fact, it ends with an... And for those of you that don't know the... I don't want to give too much of the plot away. What I would like to say about Rebecca is that if you read it when you were, I don't know, in ninth grade or something, read it again. Because I reread this some years ago, and it was a really different novel than what I had remembered. Yeah. You know, you think of Daphne du Maurier as sort of this romance writer, but in fact, this is a very dark romance. And so a lot of this is, Rebecca is in fact the first Mrs. De Winter. Mrs. De Winter, the character in the novel, never gets a name. She's always Mrs. De Winter. It's a fascinating psychological novel and has a great opening dream sequence. And at the very end of the novel, and this is not giving too much away, if you have never read Rebecca, they go back to the dream. And she's saying, "Maxim," I cried, "Maxim." And he says, "Yes," he said, "it's all right. I'm here. I had a dream," I said, "a dream. What was it?" He said, "I don't know. I don't know." Back again into the moving, unquiet depths, I was writing letters in the morning room. I was sending out invitations. I wrote them all myself with a thick black pen. And she goes on to sort of remember everything that had been happening to her during the course of this novel. It's beautifully framed. It's really a great novel. And it's called Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. It begins with a big dream sequence.
All right, Peter, what's your first?
Okay, I've attempted to organize this enormous pile of books into four groups. And the first group I want to talk about is poems and novels that came to the writer in a dream. Hmm. Because that happened. That happens. It's even happened to me. One of my books, End of Story, the whole idea of it came to me in a dream, which is nice because you're not actually doing any active work. And there, the most important thing comes to you.
Wait a second. So you had this dream and you woke up and went, oh, there's my, and you jot it down. Because a lot of times, you know, you wake up and you have this dream and then you forget it as the day goes
yeah.
on.
And I've here two problems there. One is if you don't jot it down. Two, if you have handwriting like mine and you do jot it down, and in the morning, you know, I wake up in the night, I'll have this dream. I know it's a good idea. I write it down. I look in the morning on a piece of paper. I can't read it.
It was,
you know,
thing,
it's
yeah.
just gone. Yeah. So the first one I want to do is the poem Kubla Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, like who wrote The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. So he'd been reading about Kubla Khan, and that night he, smoked opium as he was wont to do. And he had,
as one does, right?
Yes, as, of course. You know, I don't even need to say that to our listeners. And in the morning, he got up, he went right to his desk, and he had this dream, which was the poem. And he started writing it. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. And he got to that sunny dome, those caves, about 50 lines later, that sunny dome, those caves of ice, and all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, beware, beware, his flashing eyes, his floating hair, weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honeydew hath fed and drunk the milk of paradise. At that point, a person from Porlock came to the house to visit, knocked on the door. He went to answer, and he never finished. He forgot all the rest of it finished the poem at all. And it was just a fragment, and he didn't publish it till several years later when he showed it to Lord Byron. And Lord Byron thought it should be published like this. So Kubla Khan came to him in a dream, an opium-induced dream. This famous person from Porlock, because here's one of the major romantic poets, Coleridge, and because this dude showed up, we don't know what else he would have written. Okay, here's another book, or a book, actually, that also came in a dream, and that's Frankenstein by Mary Shelley.
Wow.
So it's just great, this whole story of what was going on. She was traveling with her future husband, Percy Shelley, Lord Byron, and a few other people. And they were in Switzerland, and they decided they were going to have a competition to see who could write the best horror story. And after thinking about it for days, Mary Shelley had a dream. And in that dream, she dreamed about a scientist who could create life and was horrified by what he had done. And the whole idea, Frankenstein, came in a dream. And this is a great book, by mm-hmm. the way. All the issues that we have now in terms of, you know, creating artificial life, they're all in here. It's just and just as scary as it's turning
out. And that
up.
Made our top 10 when we did the
show. Yeah, it did indeed.
10,
yeah.
Was this on the top 10?
Yes.
Well, I didn't know
10.
That.
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
That's good.
Okay, here, is this okay doing
yeah,
it like
yeah,
this?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So here's, because otherwise just censor me. And
no, you're doing well.
Here's, this is another, so continuing with books that came in a dream. The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. So this is what Stevenson's wife Fanny wrote about this book. In the small hours of one morning, I was awakened by cries of horror from Louis. Thinking he had a nightmare, I awakened him. He said angrily, "Why did you wake me? I was dreaming a fine bogey tale." And he dreamt this whole story and wrote it very quickly. His stepson said, "I don't believe there was ever such a literary feat before as the writing of Dr. Jekyll." He came downstairs. My stepfather came down in a fever, came downstairs in a fever, read nearly half the book aloud. Like, he wrote it just, I doubt if the first draft, he says, took longer than 3 days.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yes.
When you think about that. And that whole thing, why'd you wake me? How many times does it happen, like, you're having a great dream and you wake up, you go, no, I don't want to wake up yet.
Yeah, or conversely, you're having a terrible dream,
like,
you do want to wake up.
Thank goodness I'm awake. Yeah.
Get me out of this, yes.
And the last book of this, in this category, of books that were dreamed, was Stephen King's Misery. Now, in his novels, dreams are very important. There are many, many examples.
And he'll give you few dreams, nightmares.
Yes, yeah. Dozens and dozens of examples. But this book, Misery, came to him in a dream, snoozing on a transatlantic flight to London, and he wrote the idea down on a American Airlines cocktail napkin. But it just, when you think about, as we'll probably get to, that these theories that dreams have to do with working out things in your life where other parts of your mind take over on that at night. And of course, for a writer, this book is just brilliant because it's about the writer who meets his biggest fan, right, you know, quotation marks. And of course, writers are all often running into that biggest fan. And there's, of course, we love fans and we need fans. But
not fans like that.
at the outer edge of fandom is a kind of creepiness, right? I wrote a book myself called The Fan, about a baseball fan who goes somewhat too far. And so you can just see in this book, Stephen King taking that idea of the reader who's just a little too invested in the writer and pushing it to a brutal extreme. So I love the book.
That was a movie, too.
Oh, it was a great movie. Yeah. Kathy Bates.
Yep, Kathy Bates was the fan. Yeah.
Yeah. But I recommend the book. And just knowing that it came to him in a dream where he's obviously his mind is working out this sort of life of the writer and how you're going to get along with your readers. Yeah. Terrific book.
And your book, The Fan, was also a movie. Robert De Niro, right?
Yes, Robert De Niro played The Fan. Yeah. And exactly.
Okay. Jill?
Well, it was a great collection of novels, and I recommend them all.
And how did you find out that they all came in dreams? I did a little research.
Well, yes, I actually remembered that all these came in dreams from my past.
Okay. From your when you were trying to write and weren't getting any.
Yes, and a little bit of education. No, because I'd been interested in this whole idea of what. It's not just, by the way, in literature that ideas come. It comes in science, music.
Yeah, everything.
Right.
Yeah. So, but I just thought I would do this.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
As a character, as a category.
Yeah. Well, and carrying over that theme of how dreams work and what you can get out of your dreams, there is a book called The 24-Hour Mind, The Role of Sleep and Dreaming in Our Emotional Lives by Rosalind Cartwright. There has been actually a huge number of books about sleep and dream in sleeps lately, because you may have noticed a lot of people are having trouble sleeping for one reason or another. And a big part of that is looking at screens. But
there is a
great line in here where she writes, talking about the alternating states of waking and sleeping, and she writes, a shorthand way of capturing this difference is to say metaphorically that we speak prose while awake and poetry in sleep.
Huh.
So it's that sense of, you know, how your brain functions when you are in fact asleep. The beginning, she talks about collecting dreams, insomnia, sleep and dreams and depression, sleepwalking into danger, which is a whole nother topic. And she actually works in courtrooms often for people who have done bad things while they were sleepwalking. So she talks about what the brain does when it is sleepwalking. As one review said, Rosalind Cartwright has written a fascinating book about what sleep can tell us about our wakeful mind. It takes readers on a journey into the workings of the sleeping mind and what we have learned about sleep deprivation and the detrimental effects that sleep disorders have on our wakeful activities. The author has earned the title Queen of Dreams for her outstanding lifetime contribution to scientific study in the field of sleep research. This book spans the history of early sleep studies and brings us up to date with the most recent finding through case histories and scientific inquiry. So this is very much the science of dreaming, and I will say it is published by Oxford University Press. It is sort of a dry read in that it's very scientific, but also just fascinating stuff in here. She covers what we know from watching the sleeping mind, sleep and dreams and depression, people who commit murder or seek food or sex during sleepwalking episodes, the role of dreams. And she has been doing the study for a very long time. And what's interesting, and I saw this in a couple of these books about people who are studying dreams, is that other scientists don't think of it as real science
really?
Because of how you can't really know what somebody's dreaming. That you can, they have various ways that they test REM and NREM, they call it, non-REM sleep. But there is this sort of way that there is a deep untrust somehow of how science is looking at dreams, because you can't actually see them. You
sound
can't,
like a movie. Yeah, you can't look into them. It's interesting about the sleepwalking. I mean, I guess it's pretty common in children. I didn't realize that adults could actually, you know, that aren't on some kind of medication, walk around. And,
oh, it has certainly been the alibi in a number of murder cases.
Wow. That's fascinating. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a book you'd like to recommend that's on dreams or dreaming, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books on dreams and dreaming with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Peter Abrahams. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to recommend a book for our list. 866-999-4626, or our email is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Peter, you're next.
Well, Jill, I think what she was just talking about leads into this. Another thing I looked into was lucid dreaming. Had you ever heard of lucid dreaming? I hadn't. But I kind of do it, but I hadn't
just
heard of it.
You didn't know there was a name for it?
Yeah, I'd be really interested if any of our listeners know about this and have tried it. But the idea of lucid dreaming is that you, if you're aware, if you can make yourself aware that you're in a dreaming state, that's step one. Then you can begin to control your dreams, both to kind of just experience them as a fun thing, but also to avoid the nightmare, to make bad dreams turn out better. Now, I don't know. I've always had this thing where I can, not maybe not always, but going back to childhood, where I have a few little visions that I can create in my mind that lead directly to sleep and the beginning of dreams. And one of these is I'm in a cabin in a forest in a wild blizzard. And it's a very small cabin and there's a fire going, but outside is this terrible cold, and inside is this little safe space. So all the, one is a cave with the same sort of setup. Anyway, I fall right to sleep and start having a nice dream. So I can make myself sleep with this. So it's not exactly lucid dreaming.
Although lucid dreaming to say that's really fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. But lucid dreaming is controlling the dream. So the first book I brought was Exploring the World of Lucid Dreaming by Stephen LaBerge, who's this researcher, and Howard Rheingold, who I think was the writer who helped him. But here are a couple. So he teaches you these techniques, which I haven't tried. And then he takes you through a few very common dreams and what you should do in them. So, for example, being attacked, which is a common dream. Mm-hmm. Don't give in meekly to the attack or flee. Show your readiness to defend yourself, then try to engage the attacker in a conciliatory dialogue. So I don't know if you could really do that. This is a very common sort of unpleasant.
But is this something you do, like you wake up from this dream?
No, you're
in your dream.
Yes. Okay, that's a really good question. Yeah. You don't wake up, because once you wake up, you're not dreaming.
You're no longer dreaming. Yeah.
This
right.
has to be in the dream state. So the first thing you have to think is, am I dreaming? And then if you check the box, why? Yes, you're dreaming. Then you begin to use some of these techniques. Okay, so now everybody, maybe not everybody, but a lot of people have had the dream of being unprepared for a speech or an exam, right? So he also gives you directions on what to do. First of all, you don't need to continue with this theme at all. You can leave the exam or lecture room, which I love that, just not
just
doing
get
it.
Get up and leave.
Another book, more recent, is A Field Guide to Lucid Dreaming by three authors, Tusillo, Zeisel, and Peisel. And this, their techniques are the same, really. And I don't know if it works. I haven't had a chance to do it. But here's an example of someone who used the techniques and how he did it. Before going to bed, I wanted to dream about boxing. I dreamed I was going to a boxing tournament in the projects. And when I got there, they said there was no one for me to fight in my weight class. As I started to leave, I realized this was the dream that I'd been wanting to have. And it made me go lucid. I told someone to go find me a competitor. And they came back with a guy I could fight. So we started boxing in the ring. And it felt exactly like the real thing. I felt my lungs breathing, my heart rate up, my muscles when I punched. And it hurt when I took shots. I was also able to control the skill level of the guy I was fighting, so he wasn't a pushover. It felt like I was training in real life. The only difference was that I wasn't actually sustaining a bloody nose. It just felt like it. So that's lucid dreaming.
Well, and I have some help for you, Peter, if you want to try lucid dreaming. I brought one thin book on lucid dreaming, and it's A Concise Guide to Awakening in Your Dreams and in Your Life by Stephen LaBerge. And
yes,
inside
the same guy
this,
who did this first one.
This
yeah.
comes with a CD, and on this, it's got guided dream practices on the CD. So you can start with two trance inductions into the lucid dream state, and then there are two daytime exercises designed to trigger lucid dreams at night, and LaBerge's breakthrough mild technique for increasing lucid dream probability fivefold or more, and then finally a Tibetan yoga dream practice. So if you should need more about how to do this. This is the book for you by the same fellow, Stephen LaBerge, Lucid Dreaming, which was interestingly put out by Sounds True, which does a lot of CDs, but not as many books. So they've combined this with a book. And he writes in here, not to put too fine a point on it, I believe that this traditional view of nightmares is simply wrong. Yes, nightmares are frightening, but that does not mean they are bad or meaningless or without positive value. On the contrary, nightmares contain a great deal of potential energy that can provide the impulse for psychological development. Reframing nightmares as opportunities for growth is an important key to learning from your dreams. With a flexible and lucid approach to life, there are no bad dreams. For all of you that are having bad dreams.
I don't know. Sometimes when you wake up with that and your heart's pounding, I don't know. I wouldn't say that's a good experience, but maybe, I don't know, maybe your brain's getting something out of that. All right, what's your next book?
Well, I had to bring one poem. It is National Poetry Month, and this is such a beautiful poem on dreams. It is in Mark Strand's Collected Poems, and it is not surprisingly called Dreams, and speaks sort of to the lucid dreaming problem. Trying to recall the plot and characters we dreamed, what life was like before the morning came, we are seldom satisfied, and even then there is no way of knowing if what we know is true. Something nameless hums us into sleep, withdraws, and leaves us in a place that seems always vaguely familiar. Perhaps it is because we take the props and fixtures of our days with us into the dark, assuring ourselves we are still alive. And yet nothing here is certain. Landscapes merge with one another. Houses are never where they should be. Doors and windows sometimes open out to other doors and windows. Even the person who seems most like ourselves cannot be counted on, for there have been too many times when he, like everything else, has done the unexpected. And as the night wears on, the dim allegory of ourselves unfolds, and we feel dreamed by someone else, a sleeping counterpart who gathers in the darkness of his person shades of the real world. Nothing is clear. We are not ever sure if the life we live there belongs to us. Each night, it is the same. Just when we're on the verge of catching on, a sense of our remoteness closes in, and the world so lately seen gradually fades from sight. We wake to find the sleeper is ourselves, and the dreamt of is someone who did something we can't quite put our finger on, but which involved a life we are always, we feel, about to discover. That is Dreams by Mark Strand.
All right, Peter.
Well, I should. Okay, since. Well,
you got books and pages and all kinds of stuff over here.
Okay, yes. So, because I've tried to organize it, but of course it's slipping through my fingers. Okay, my next category would be, I suppose, the science of dreaming. And I think the first person you have to talk about is Sigmund Freud. The interpretation of dreams, which is, okay, this is not an easy read. It's not light reading, but it's fascinating because his mind was just so, he was so brilliant and he was just a pioneer of all kinds of things. But before a lot of the hard science was done, so a lot of what he came up with is no longer really accepted as true. But basically, he said that dream interpretation was the royal road to understanding the unconscious mind, which I thought was just this brilliant insight. And so his, just to sum it up, he believed that dreams came from the libidinal drive, and that sexually aggressive desires suppressed by the by the mind during daylight hours were free to roam at night. And so that, The Interpretation of Dreams, Freud, a really important book. Also, you have Carl Jung, and he wrote a book. He also, you know, investigated this, and he wrote a book called Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. And he didn't agree with Freud, that he thought the dream itself as an intact body contained the whole meaning of the dream. And he posited the idea of the collective unconscious that we're all part of, and that dreams were a window into that. And I think, in fact, a lot of the science is now saying that Jung was right about that. So this is another really fascinating book. And just something that's just a bonus is that with modern life, that Carl Jung is on YouTube. This is really worth going to. If you put in Carl Jung face-to-face, BBC, okay, the BBC had an interview program called Face-to-Face, and John Freeman, who was the editor of the New Statesman magazine at that time, a fantastic interviewer, not at all in the American style, much more the British style, but he had Carl Jung on.
Wow.
Just the two of them talking, and it's incredible.
How did you find
how
that?
How good it is.
Dude, would just Google Carl Jung and it came up?
Someone had told me that it's out there.
Wow, that's
and
amazing.
And it's terrific. So I recommend this book, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, but also you should spend half an hour listening
Seeing him. And we can definitely put the link up to that when we put the book list up.
Yeah. It's not all on dreams by any means, but it's just about Carl Jung and his whole life. He's speaking English, which he does great, by the way. And you just, some people have, they're on another plane and you can just see it right away. And Carl Jung was. I don't think there are many Carl Jungs. The culture doesn't encourage that kind of person anymore. The education he had is just, no one gets that education, you know, Latin and Greek, and knowing, being able to synthesize all, because he was very interested in myth and all that kind of thing, and it fits in with dreams perfectly. Okay, my last one on this is kind of the fairly up-to-date state of science, and this book is called The Mind at Night by Andrea Rock, who is not a scientist, but this is, who is a journalist and a very good writer who's investigated the science of dreaming. So just, they found out so much, but one of the most important things is they divide up the sections of the brain and see what's going on at night. And one of the things is that the limbic part of the brain, which I think is a more primitive part, the mammalian part, takes over at night, and it's the part that's concerned with emotions. So a lot of the things that go on in your life in the daytime on the prefrontal part, you know, the superhuman conscious part, that part lets go at night. And so the same things that you did during the day, the experiences you had, are now gone over by a different guy at work inside your mind on the emotional level. And apparently that's a lot of at night, one of the things we're doing with dreams is the brain is is cleaning up, and the limbic system takes over and works on what happened. So this is just something of what they found out. The chief character in our nightly dramas is nearly always the dreamer, but about 95% of our dreams involve other characters too. The rest of the cast consists of people, animals, and mythical figures, with adults dreaming mostly of other adults. Animals feature more prominently in the dreams of children and people living in more primitive societies. Homes or other buildings are the most common dream settings, and automobiles or other conveyances also frequently pop up as scenes for dream action. The majority of dreams during REM sleep are filled with motion, especially walking or running, while dreams in other phases, like the limbic system of sleep, are less action-oriented. The Mind at Night, Andrea Rock.
Interesting. You said one of the common dreams is homes. And I don't remember I heard this, but you know how they have sometimes these columns and newspapers that tell you what your dreams meant. And they say that when you dream of a house, it's yourself and some kind of self-discovery or something like that. It would be kind of fun to do one of those columns, wouldn't it, to like interpret people's dreams? Because they don't really know what's going on, right? They're making this stuff up, right?
Well, of course, the Bible, there's lots of dream interpretation that goes on in the Bible.
Right, this is true.
Yes.
And I just wanted to say a word about Freud, because the It turns out, and I don't know that I knew this or only knew this once I saw this book. There's actually a kid's book called Salvador Dali and the Surrealists, Their Lives and Ideas. And it's, in fact, a fabulous book. It's really a history of surrealism. And they talk in here about Freud's influence on them. And there's, in fact, a whole biography on Freud in here, in among everything else. It writes about Dali. Soon after his return to Madrid, Dali began reading the work of Sigmund Freud, which had just been translated into Spanish. Freud's writing was a major discovery for Dali. He began to see his life in a whole new way. Dali's interest in Freud made him pay attention to every dream he had and to try to interpret their meanings. Everything in his life, even apparently accidental happenings, now appeared in a different light. Freud had changed Dali's way of examining his own life and the lives of those around him. And this book goes into talking about how you can keep a dream journal. It's actually, while it's written for kids, I think a lot of adults would also enjoy this book. And so it talks about André Breton's first Surrealist Manifesto, an essay about surrealism published in 1924. He stated that modern people were discontent because they were separated from the imaginative realm of dream and fantasy. He added that young children and insane people had more freedom of thought since they weren't bothered with the importance of rational thinking. It didn't matter to them if their thoughts made sense any more than we might expect a dream to make sense. And so he has this whole little, you know, workshop, like what you need in order to write down your dreams. And the materials for this are notebook, pencil, flashlight. So very simple things to do, but sort of fascinating. It also talks about Dali and film. Very interesting. And it's called Salvador Dali and the Surrealists, Their Lives and Ideas. I found another short book about Dali. And this is Dali by Catherine Ingram. And this has these great explanations for what are in his paintings. So there's this painting called Honey is Sweeter Than Blood. And here's just a little bit about what they say is from the dream world. While remaining wary of surrealism, more and more Dali borrowed from their repertoire. He started exploring a central theme of surrealism, dreams. In his study, For Honey is Sweeter Than Blood, we enter a dream. Everything is asleep. The body is slumped in slumber, and the eyes of the severed head are closed. As the body rests, the mind center of imagination and dreams is brightly colored and full of life. Dream thoughts are presented in scattered images, and it goes on to talk about all these little bits that are in this dream. And he also has a painting where Freud is actually in one of the paintings. Really interesting and sort of a lovely introduction to surrealism as well for kids or adults.
Right, and it fits in so well with dream surrealism and movies too. It's almost like we invented movies in our dreams long before movies even came along. That's why I think one of the great things, one of the reasons movies are so attractive is the innately inherent dreamlike quality of them. But I forgot to mention, now that you bring this up, because now you're talking about dreaming and the art of painting, really.
Right,
but
right.
Of course, in this book, I was talking about the mind at night, the science. It's also in the world of music. Paul McCartney woke up one morning in May of 1965 with a haunting tune running through his mind. In the dream he'd just awakened from, he'd been listening to the same melody being played by a classical string ensemble. He was so taken with the sound that he immediately got up and began playing the notes he'd heard on the keys of the upright piano next to his bed in his mother's home in London, where the Beatles were filming Help. Because he'd dreamed the tune, he was convinced it must be someone else's song that he'd heard somewhere along the way. And he began,
what song was it?
And he began checking, and he couldn't find it anywhere, and that song was Yesterday.
Oh, interesting.
And it turns out he was not the only musician to come up with a song in a dream. Apparently Keith Richards also came up with Satisfaction in a dream, and it is so interesting to hear him talk about it. He says, I go to bed as usual with my guitar, and I wake up the next morning, and I see that the tape is run to the very end, and I think, well, I didn't do anything. Maybe I hit a button when I was asleep. So I put it back to the beginning and pushed play, and there, in some sort of ghostly version, is the opening lines to satisfaction. It was a whole verse of it. And after that, there's 40 minutes of me snoring. But there's the song in its embryo, and I actually dreamt the damn thing. And that is talked about in a book called Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams by Matthew Walker, which is a brand new book. And it talks a lot about sleep. He loves sleep. He's actually Berkeley's sleep and neuroimaging. He works in Berkeley's sleep and neuroimaging lab, where he and his team, along with their peers, have made significant strides over the last 20 years in understanding the restorative powers of sleep. He says, sleep is the single most effective thing we can do to reset our brains and body health each day. Mother Nature's best effort yet at contra death. And he also talks about here about how what we are doing right now and why people are having so much trouble sleeping and thus not dreaming has to do with all the screens we're looking at. He has all manner of statistics and clinical studies to back him up. It really is true that you'll have a harder time falling asleep after reading a book on an LED device than you will after reading one printed on old-fashioned paper. The blue light emitted by an iPad suppresses your brain's natural release of melatonin, the hormone that induces sleepiness, by over 50%.
Wow,
so this is why there's now like this whole industry trying to make your screens a different color when you go to sleep. I mean, you can do that with Twitter now. They have like the night light for Twitter. It is very problematic that people are not sleeping.
Yes, and there's something Orwellian going on, and I'll get to that too. But right, well, but going back to Keith,
we'll go ahead quickly, and then we got to go to a break. We're over.
Just going back to Keith. Apparently, in The Mind at Night, they say that drugs, alcohol, coffee, all interfere with a good sleep and good dreams. But I guess for Keith, it really doesn't matter.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books on dreams and dreaming with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Peter Abrahams. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I forgot whose turn it is, so Warnie, go ahead.
Well, I just want to say a word about Sleeping Beauty.
Oh, that's right. Sleeping
we
Beauty,
did
mention
she
dream?
Sleeping Beauty. Well, this came to me as we were thinking about doing the show. It's like, well, do I remember any dreams that Sleeping Beauty? Now, keep in mind, Sleeping Beauty slept for 100 years. One would think there'd be some dreams. And so I went back to the original story that I had read when I was a child, and it says, not one word about dreaming. She says, now, however, the 100 years were just ended and the day had come when Briar Rose was to wake up again. And so, of course, she does wake up. We know what happens. The prince is there. Everything is great. However, what I did discover was that in a book that I had talked about when we were doing the tree show, it turns out that somebody, in fact, has also wondered about whether Sleeping Beauty ever had dreams and wrote this little story called The Dreams of the Sleeping Beauty. And she goes for, she has 100 different dreams, just sort of one sentence each of what Sleeping Beauty might have been dreaming about when she was asleep. And a lot of this, needless to say, because it is about forests, the whole book is about forests and trees. A lot of it is about forests and trees. And here's just a little bit of here are her last couple of dreams. She dreamed her belly swelling with new life. 99. She dreams that the dream time is coming to an end. 100. And that when she is ready, when the spring comes sweetly and the primroses flower, a prince will cut his way through the protective undergrowth and kiss her awake. And so she actually dreams her saving in this version of Sleeping Beauty. And it is from a book called From the Forest, A Search for the Hidden Roots of Our Fairy Tales by Sarah Maitland. So apparently Sleeping Beauty did dream.
We have an email from Lee who says, in the spring of 1995, I woke up from a dream that I had opened a store called I Used to Be a Tree. I even saw the font, which was kind of balloony letters. I had no business experience but loved to shop and arrange things, so ran with the idea, opened a store within 6 months, and had it for 15 years.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well,
that is the power of dreams.
That's right. Okay.
And this leads into, I was now is my fiction pile, and that leads perfect. She couldn't have done. What is the name of that listener?
Lee.
Okay, you couldn't have done better, because the first thing I want to talk about is Delmore Schwartz's famous short story, In Dreams Begin Responsibilities, which fits in exactly with that. Now, Delmore Schwartz took that title from Yeats, who had In Dreams Begins Responsibility, slightly changed, but Yeats attributed it to some earlier saying, so I couldn't actually track down where it first started, so I think it would be Yeats, but Delmore Schwartz, I don't know if people know about him. He was one of these golden boys of American literature between the wars, but had not a good life particularly, and was like one of these highly promising people who never quite, you know, came through, except for this one short story in Dreams Begin Responsibilities, which is a terrific short story in which the character goes into a movie theater and sees a very old-fashioned black and white jumpy movie, and in it are his two parents meeting and courting and falling in love, and the character jumps up in the movie theater and yells, "Don't do it, don't do it." And so it's a very dream space kind of story. And Delmore Schwartz grew up in a nightmarish household of his two parents not getting along. And so this expresses it perfectly. Anyway, it's a great short story, and he taught at a number of places, including Syracuse University. And one of his students there was Lou Reed, of Velvet Underground, you know, the musician. Yeah. And Lou Reed reads this short story also on YouTube. So if you go to YouTube, you can find Lou Reed reading In Dreams Begin Responsibilities.
We will put a link up to that as well.
Jill.
I brought along one book called Dreamcatchers, Legend, Lore, and Artifacts. For those of you that don't know what a dreamcatcher is, it is a beautiful, actually, let me tell you what they say a dreamcatcher is, because it's actually, there's a legend involved with the dreamcatcher. The legend of the dreamcatcher began long ago when the child of a woodland chief fell ill. Unsettled by fever, the child was plagued with bad dreams and unable to sleep. In an attempt to heal him, the tribe's medicine woman created a device that would catch these bad dreams. Forming a circle with a slender willow branch, she filled the center with sinew using a pattern borrowed from our brother the spider, who weaves a web. This dream catcher was then hung over the bed of the child. Soon the fever broke and the child slept peacefully. It is said that at night, when dreams visit, they are caught in the dream catcher's web, and only the good dreams are able to find their way to the dreamer, filtering down through the feather. When the warmth of the morning sun arrives, it burns away the bad dreams that have been caught. The good dreams, now knowing the path, visit again on other nights. And this book is full of these beautiful, and these were created by the indigenous people. They have, and it is full of spectacularly beautiful photographs of dream catchers, which are beautiful in their own right, the photographs.
Very pretty.
But it also talks a lot about the history of who originally invented this. And of course, now you can purchase, as they say, purchase dream catchers at First Nations and Native American art centers, powwows, airport kiosks, museum gift shops, bargain stores, and any number of other venues or gatherings. But they have a much richer history than you might know.
Yeah, I like that story.
Well, going back to fiction, Henry James said, "Tell a dream, lose a reader." So, and I think,
which a lot of people seem to still adhere by.
Well, there is that. Well, here's the thing, because from a writing standpoint, there's something a little bit cheap about doing it, because it's so easy to write a dream, because you just, the imagination doesn't have to be tethered to following the story and advancing it. But you can do it still, but you can just sort of let yourself go. I myself have been fairly strict about not doing it, but certainly in the Chet and Bernie series, Chet the Dog Does Dream. Maybe I'll get to a slight one there, but but there are, of course, many books where dreams have featured, and one of the most well-known is A Christmas Carol by Dickens, of course, where the dream is the whole thing. But just the end, In his agony, he caught the spectral hand. It sought to free itself, but he was strong in his entreaty and detained it. The spirit, stronger yet, repulsed him. Holding up his hands in one last prayer to have his fate reversed, he saw an alteration in the phantom's hood and dress. It shrunk, collapsed, and dwindled down into a bedpost. And he wakes up from the dream. So, a wonderful use of dreams in A Christmas Carol.
And another novel that very much features dreaming is a more recent novel called The Manual of Detection by Jedediah Barry. This is a fabulous read, very confusing, though, as you read it, but beautifully. If you like, for example, Wes Anderson films, you might like this novel as well. As one reviewer said, describing Jedediah Barry's novel is no simple task. Any halfway accurate comparison requires mixing and matching things that don't really go together, like Columbo or Alice in Wonderland and one of Kafka's sinister office buildings. It's a detective story, but there's a lot more going on in this detective story. And the detectives, as it turns out, have to actually go into people's dreams in order to solve the mystery. So he talks about how this happens, and the response is, I'd say it's a lot of nonsense, but the mind struggles with the question nonetheless. How often have you tried to recall a specific memory, a conversation with an acquaintance maybe, only to determine that the memory was a delusion spawned in dream? And how often have you dreamed a thing, then found that it spoke some truth about your waking life? You solved a problem that had been impenetrable the day before, perhaps, or perceived the hidden sentiments of someone whose motivations had baffled you. This is a fascinating, it is sort of a mystery. It's sort of a meditation on dreaming, and it's beautifully, beautifully written. It's called The Manual of Detection, a novel by Jedediah Barry.
Yeah. What we haven't brought up, but I think we talked about, is people who have passed on visiting you in their dreams. Right? That happens. I think everybody has those dreams.
And it's interesting. Somebody actually called me earlier this week, a listener, and said, would we be talking about this? And I did find a book that just came out called The Awakened Dreamer, How to Remember and Interpret Your Dreams by someone named Kayla Ambrose. And she actually has a whole section in here, and she's a psychic. She speaks to the other side, and she has a whole section called visitation dreams, which it sounds like, from what this woman had described to me earlier this week, was what she had, where a year after her husband had passed, she had this very intense dream about him being with her in the room. And this whole section on visitation dreams from people on the other side is really fascinating. And there are all kinds of ways that you can sort of help that along, according to this author, who, again, is a psychic. And she talks about all the important ways that you can use dreams in your life to solve problems and talk to people who are no longer with us.
All right.
Well, I may not be getting to some of these. I can see the clock.
We're not going to get all of them.
Such as Where the Wild Things Are. I'm not going to get to that. The Wizard of Oz. Midsummer Night's Dream, yeah. Possibly the very best thing written with dreams.
Shakespeare was huge on dreams.
Yes, but I just want to mention 1984 by George Orwell, which is, I just read it again for this show. This is a book that's getting better and better. The telescreens, it's so much like what's happening with the facial recognition in where Chinese policemen now apparently are walking down the street and identifying people through name with their little Google glasses. But in 1984, dreams are really important because the character, in his dreams, the freedom of the past is kept alive, but he also has dreams about the future where he thinks he's going to be in the place where there's no more darkness. He hears Winston hears O'Brien saying that. And of course, he does get to that place, but it ends up being the horror. So yeah. I would really recommend 1984.
That book, I mean, it's been flying off the library shelves for sure.
It's a very popular book right now.
And we are going to have a link to all the books we talked about. So if you missed some, that'll be later today. Jill's going to put that list together, and we'll have a link at our website, capeandislands.org. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Peter Abrahams, author of many books. Thank you both. We could go on for another hour, couldn't we?
We could.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.